In sports, it's hard to go out on top, but just days after winning the World Series, the manager of the St. Louis Cardinals, Tony La Russa, is doing just that. The Cardinals announced yesterday that after 16 seasons with the team, La Russa will retire. He's been a major league manager for 33 years. He took the Cardinals to the playoffs 9 times, made it to the World Series 3 times, and won it all twice, including this year. La Russa is the winningest manager in the Cardinals' history. And as St. Louis Public Radio's Rachel Lippman reports, the organization and its fans now have to figure out how to move on without a man who had become the face and the backbone of a proud organization.
It wasn't a Halloween trick. There was Cardinals general manager John Mozeliak 3 days after the team had won the World Series, making a major and surprising announcement about the future.
As we continue to enjoy the celebration of winning our 11th World Championship, I'm here to announce that Tony has decided to retire.
La Russa did not make the decision on the fly. The notoriously cerebral 67-year-old has been in baseball for almost 50 years. He says the doubts he has every year were stronger than ever. He told Mozeliak and team owner Bill DeWitt Jr. of his plans in August. Players and coaches found out Sunday after the World Series parade and rally. Cardinal Nation found out Monday. Fan Gabrielle Sale was shocked.
I knew he was thinking about it, but it really makes me upset now because I don't know what's going to happen to the team. It makes me worried a little.
La Russa's trademark intensity has often complicated his relationship with those fans, arguably among the best in baseball. He says he joked with his wife, Elaine, about how many people would cheer his departure.
I have no regrets about looking at them and saying, I did the best I could, and the numbers are what they are.
La Russa's numbers are Hall of Fame worthy. He's third on the all-time wins list. He's got 3 World Series rings, 1 with the Oakland Athletics, 2 with the Cardinals. He's just the second manager behind Sparky Anderson to win titles in both the National and American Leagues. Cardinals owner Bill DeWitt Jr. says he and Mozeliak will look far and wide for La Russa's replacement.
We're certainly going to make every effort to get the best manager available. But as I said to Tony, we're not going to find Tony La Russa out there. I mean, you know, given his career and what he's accomplished and what he's meant to the Cardinals.
For pitcher Chris Carpenter, La Russa means everything. Carpenter was a .500 pitcher with the Toronto Blue Jays, but he signed with the Cardinals in 2003 and racked up 6 winning seasons, including 2005, when he won the National League Cy Young Award as the best pitcher.
It's been a pleasure to be with him for as long as I have. He's taught me a lot. Taught me a lot about this game.
Both La Russa and DeWitt say the club is in a good place. Carpenter is locked down for another year, as are most of the other core players, except for one big name. La Russa is the only manager that free agent first baseman Albert Pujols has ever known. The two have one of the closest player-manager relationships in baseball. So La Russa's decision adds fuel to the parlor game of the moment here in St. Louis. What will Pujols do? Count Bill Kistner among the fans who think Cardinal Nation won't like the answer.
It's not particularly good news coming off a World Series win. And I don't know, I'm very worried about the implications that has with our ability to re-sign Pujols. I think that was one of the biggest draws for him to staying with the team.
Baseball writer Stan McNeil of the Online Sporting News agrees that La Russa's departure can't help, but he doesn't think it hurts as much as others do.
I think Albert realized that Tony would not be managing throughout Albert's playing career, whether that was here in St. Louis or elsewhere.
And he says if the Cardinals make a postseason run next year, La Russa's retirement will be just another event in the history books. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Lippman in St. Louis.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Americans have a healthcare system that is huge, high-tech, innovative, expensive, and that doesn't always deliver on the basics. That's a reality that President Obama sought to address yesterday.
People with cancer, infections, nutritional disorders, and other problems sometimes can't get the drugs they need. There have been over 200 drug shortages in the past year.
The president issued an executive order to attack that problem. It's part of his campaign to take actions that do not require congressional approval. NPR's Richard Knox reports on whether the order is enough.
At the most basic level, Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius says drug shortages are a matter of supply and demand.
Demand for medications is growing, while capacity of manufacturing facilities has not. Now, that's not something we can control.
The government can't order drug makers to build more factories, but President Obama hopes he can get companies to give the government more notice when a shortage might be looming. That can enable the Food and Drug Administration to persuade other companies to gear up and bridge the gap. The administration is increasing the FDA's staff to deal with drug shortages from 5 people now to 11. Pressure to do something about drug shortages has been building over the past few months. Some of the most wrenching stories involve cancer patients who can't get the chemotherapy their oncologists prescribe.
All oncologists in the United States, whether they like to admit it or not, have had patients that have been affected and may have had their prognosis become worse or may have died from the drug shortages.
That's Dr. Hagop Kantarjian of the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. But cancer patients aren't the only victims. Michael Cohen of the Institute for Safe Medication Practices says the group surveyed 1,000 hospitals and discovered lots of different problems.
We had, in some cases, anesthetics that weren't available, and they were using alternatives that the anesthesiologists weren't used to using. And there were some cases reported to us where people were waking up during surgery.
Other patients died when they couldn't get the right antibiotic, or when they got an overdose of painkiller because medical personnel were unfamiliar with the dosing schedule of a substitute drug. Cohen says a root cause of the shortages is a consolidation of companies that make old-line generic drugs, many of them intravenous medications used in hospitals.
We only have about 5, 6, maybe 7 generic injection manufacturers that are still out there, whereas before we had probably scores of them.
So when one company's production line goes down, the remaining suppliers can't take up the slack. Some middlemen are quick to take advantage of the shortages. They scoop up the available supply and raise the price by 3% and 4,000%. The president wants the Justice Department to look into that kind of price gouging. The reason so few companies are interested in making these older drugs in the first place is that there's not much money in it.
That has absolutely been a reason that some of the manufacturers have stopped making a product. It just hasn't been profitable enough.
That's a tough problem to solve. Most countries control the price of drugs. They keep the price of generic drugs higher, and they cap the prices of brand-name drugs. That makes the generics more attractive to make. Price controls don't seem to be in the cards here, so the Obama administration is trying to manage drug shortages better. Administration officials acknowledge that might take more than a presidential order. They say they need legislation to require drug makers to warn them when a shortage might be coming. Richard Knox, NPR News.
The television hit The Office is populated with types, albeit exaggerated ones, types you'd find in the workplace. There's been the inappropriate boss, Michael Scott, the power-hungry misfit, Dwight Schrute, and the perpetual teenager, Kelly Kapoor. She's a boy-crazy shopaholic, frivolous, and celebrity-obsessed. She also happens to be Indian-American.
I bet you get pulled over by the cops a lot just because of your race.
Well, they say it's because of texting, but maybe you're right.
I think you should consider applying for the Executive Minority Training Program.
Never thought of myself as an executive before.
I know, because you have no role models. How many Indian CEOs can you think of?
I can't think of any CEOs, any race.
You could be the Indian Bill Gates.
I could be the Indian Julia Roberts.
That's not... She's... Okay.
Mindy Kaling is the actress who brings Kelly to life on The Office, where she's also a writer and executive producer, and now add the title author of a book of essays about her life called Is Everyone Hanging Out Without Me? Now, she may be a fashion-conscious Hollywood type these days, but the back cover of her book shows the child Mindy, thick glasses, ill-fitting sweater, and hair cropped into a bowl cut.
I can't believe how little effort my parents put into making me seem like an appealing little girl. I mean, I feel like you sometimes hear celebrities, they'll show photos of themselves, and they're like, I can't believe how unattractive I was. And when you really were not a very attractive kid, you really want to be like, oh, no, I was the real deal. See this photo.
You do write about high school and not being very popular in high school, but the way you write about it is not to worry. The last thing what anyone needs is to have high school as the high point of your life.
You know, that's one of those things where I wrote that, and even if I had heard that as a 15-year-old, that don't worry about being popular in high school, even I know that that might be just completely futile advice. I mean, I was obsessed with being popular when I was in high school, and I never achieved it. There's photos from our high school musicals and things, and I'm comically in the deep background wearing a beggar's costume. There are musicals I didn't even know there were beggars, and I managed to play them. I played a street urchin in Evita. In City of Angels, I played a Los Angeles hobo. Whatever they could find the sort of desperate-looking urchin in a musical, our drama teacher managed to find a part for me playing it.
Well, you discovered you were funny, and you discovered you had a lot of appeal when you hit college. You know, it seemed like you blossomed.
I felt incredibly special in college. I was really lucky. I mean, I went to Dartmouth College, so simply by being an Indian American woman, I was already so statistically interesting. And then the fact that I didn't want to do anything science related and I wanted to write comedy plays and act a little bit, I mean, I became deeply interesting at college because of how rare that was.
Another rarity Mindy Kaling writes about, being average-sized in stick-skinny Hollywood. Here she reads an excerpt from the book.
Since I am not model skinny, but also not super fat and fabulously owning my hugeness, I fall into that nebulous, quote-unquote, normal American woman size that legions of fashion stylists detest. For the record, I'm a size 8, this week anyway. Many stylists hate that size because I think to them it shows that I lack the discipline to be an ascetic or the confident, sassy abandon to be a total fatty hedonist. They're like, pick a lane. Just be so enormous that you need to be buried in a piano and dress accordingly.
This is the sort of reality that Kaling mines, as when Kelly Kapoor experiments with crazy fad diets.
We always think of I was on a diet with a big groan, but I think diets are fun. I think it is an American pastime for a lot of women. I don't know. I think that Kelly thinks of dieting as a fun hobby to have.
Well, there is one moment in one of the episodes where Kelly is concocting. It's this terrible diet. It's hot sauce and grapefruit juice.
This is real. This is the
it's a real diet. Yeah,
it's a real diet, which Beyonce Knowles famously went on to lose weight for Dreamgirls. Kelly heard it and then she tried the diet, did it for 4 days, and then fainted. I think at work.
You're shaking. Are you all right?
Just leave me alone!
I am on the third day of my cleanse diet. All I have to do is drink maple syrup, lemon juice, cayenne pepper, and water for all three meals. I just bought some bikinis online, size 2. So, I look amazing.
And you, Kelly, look like a zombie. It's like...
Yes, I do look like someone from The Walking Dead. That's pretty well observed. If you've ever done a diet like that, an incredibly restrictive diet, which I'm embarrassed to say I have tried for very short periods of time, you do become, your personality does change into that kind of Walking Dead personality.
You know, you're known, obviously, as a character on The Office, which has a cult following, practically. But you have a lot of followers on Twitter. We're talking, what, a couple of million?
I think right now I have 1.5 million.
Oh, only 1.5 million, eh? Well, sorry.
Whenever you brag about how many Twitter followers you have, like, I think Kim Kardashian has close to 10 million. Lady Gaga has more than some huge nation. So I sort of pale in comparison to that.
Can you stop micromanaging? I know how to do this.
Okay.
You're yelling.
What are you guys doing?
This girl was really rude to me at the mall. Mm-hmm. So I created a fake IM account from a hot guy at her high school, and now I'm trying to make her anorexic.
Tell her everyone in the homeroom thinks she's fat.
Oh, that is so good.
Mindy Kaling as Kelly Kapoor. She's also a writer and producer for The Office, and her collection of essays is called Is Everyone Hanging Out Without Me? All I can say is we're hanging out here on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Halloween is over, which means in some quarters it's already time for holiday shopping. The big movie studios are hoping lots of people have DVDs on their lists. That's right, DVDs, even in this world of streaming media. Commentator Andrew Wallenstein says the studios are adding a new feature to DVDs in hopes of helping sales. It's called Ultraviolet.
When was the last time you bought a DVD? If you're like a lot of people, it's probably been a while, given the wealth of options popping up online. If you want to watch, say, Iron Man 2, you could stream it from Netflix, Amazon, or iTunes.
Therefore, what I'm saying, if I'm saying anything, is welcome back to the Stark Expo.
But as popular as these online rentals are, they provide much smaller profit margins to studios than the DVD. Discs used to make a ton of money, but people don't buy them as much as they used to. That's why the major studios are advertising a new system that makes purchasing popular again, with Ultraviolet.
Now, when you buy Green Lantern, it comes with a new Ultraviolet digital copy.
Cool, huh?
That lets you build your own movie collection in the cloud.
The cloud is a virtual storage system that keeps movies from filling up your hard drive. As many as a dozen big movies should be powered by Ultraviolet by the end of the year.
There's new freedom with new Ultraviolet digital copy.
Beware my power. Green Lantern's light!
But Ultraviolet has a huge problem. The whole idea of owning a movie doesn't make sense anymore. Now the consumers have gotten so wise to how easy digital rentals are. That is, unless you're like a 6-year-old who can't get enough of a Disney movie like Toy Story.
To infinity and beyond!
But therein lies another problem. Disney is the only major studio that isn't involved in Ultraviolet, at least not yet. And Apple and Amazon have their own cloud services. At least Ultraviolet purchases can play on phones and tablets made by Apple, and same for Android. Problem is, there's one device you might have heard of where it won't play yet. The TV. That may be okay if I have the DVD, but I shouldn't have to carry that around should I want to watch on someone else's TV. Ultraviolet's backers say they plan on making it TV-friendly, and there's plenty more innovations to come, too. Don't forget how much the studios have at stake, considering they're the ones making these movies. Now, they just have to figure out a better way for us to watch them.
Commentator Andrew Wallenstein is TV editor at Variety.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Allison Keyes. Michelle Martin is away. Coming up, need cash for your upcoming holiday? We'll give you a primer on the chances of getting a job this holiday season and whether or not that's a good thing. But first, we wanted to turn to a story that's been getting a lot of attention on the news lately, student loan debt. President Obama announced last week that he was moving forward with changes to federal policies to make it easier for students to afford and pay back federal college loans. But we wondered whether that could help grads like Erica Woods Tucker of Raleigh, North Carolina. She recently left this comment on our Facebook page about the struggle to pay back her loans.
I currently owe $40,000 in student loans. I defer them because I don't make enough money to pay them. I'll probably be paying them into my 80s. My husband is laid off, and his loan went into default. The loan company refused to reduce the loan payment or defer it. It's $350 a month. He breaks on less than half of what he did when he was working. We have three kids, and the loan payment is more than what we pay for my youngest daughter to go to pre-K. We want to pay the loan, but it'd be nice to have some help from someone.
Erica's just one of the millions of Americans with college debt, and depending on who you ask, the total outstanding student loan debt in America is somewhere between $500 billion and $1 trillion. To find out how President Obama's plan might affect that, I'm joined by Mark Kantrowitz. He's the publisher of FastWeb.com and FinAid.org. Thanks, Mark, for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Mark, talk to us about exactly what changes President Obama has planned for the policy.
Yeah, there are two main changes. One has to do with a safety net program called income-based repayment. Income-based repayment bases your monthly payment on a percentage of your discretionary income as opposed to the amount you owe. The current income-based repayment plan, it uses a percentage that's 15% with any remaining debt forgiven after 25 years in repayment. Congress passed a change that would go into effect on July 1, 2014, that would reduce the monthly payment by a third from 15% to 10% and push up the forgiveness from 25 years to 20 years. President Obama is pushing this change forward by 2 years so that it will be available to students who borrow loans next year.
And this is only about federal loans, right? Not private?
This is just federal loans, not private. One of the advantages of federal education loans is that they are available for income-based repayment and also an add-on program called public service loan forgiveness. Just the student loans, not parent loans, and not private student loans.
So who exactly is going to be helped by these policies?
It's a little complicated. You can't have any student loan debt from before 2008. So as of January 1st, 2008, you have to have been a new borrower. and you also have to take out at least one loan in 2012 or a later year. And this helps students who are currently in school and are taking on more loans next year, not students who have already graduated.
What if your loan is already in default? Does this help you?
It does not. It's not available to borrowers who are in default unless they rehabilitate their loans, which you can do by making 9 out of 10 consecutive full voluntary on-time monthly payments, in which case they would be able to get income-based repayment. But someone already in default who doesn't rehabilitate their loans can't get income-based repayment.
How much will this save people that are able to take advantage of this program real time? I mean, are we talking just a reduction in monthly loan payments?
We're talking about a reduction in monthly loan payments. It cuts the payments by a third.
So that's like a couple of hundred dollars maybe in some cases?
In some cases, it could be hundreds and maybe even as much as $1,000. But it makes the monthly payments affordable. Under the new income-based repayment plan, the typical borrower will see monthly payments that are 6 or 7% or less of their gross monthly income.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Allison Keyes. We're talking about student loan debt and President Obama's plan for providing grads with some relief. Our guest is Mark Kantrowitz of FinAid.org. You have concluded that the total amount of student loan debt is about $1 trillion. How'd you get there, and how significant is that?
My trillion-dollar figure for both federal and private education debt is based on the federal budget, looking at two successive snapshots of total student loan debt outstanding and projecting it forward, and a repayment trajectory model for private student loans. And this model has worked quite well. It's within a few tens of billions of dollars of the actual figure. The U.S. Department of Education recently noted that total federal education loan debt outstanding as of the end of September 2011 was at $848 billion.
Wow.
And add on somewhere between $120 and $160 billion of private student loan debt outstanding, and the total is very close to $1 trillion, if not perhaps over it.
Mark, how much of a difference will the president's plan make here? Will it help prevent defaults on student loans, or do you think it'll lead students to borrow more?
Income-based repayment is a safety net. If you're living under 150% of the poverty line, your monthly payment under income-based repayment is actually zero. So there's never really any reason why someone should default on their federal education loans, given that they have the availability of something like income-based repayment. It makes the monthly payments more affordable.
If so many people are, despite that, having trouble repaying their loans, should the government be doing something to make getting them harder in the first place?
It's more about providing better options for financial relief, perhaps allowing people to discharge these loans in bankruptcy if they have an issue that's going to persist for most of the life of the loans.
What might another option be?
Well, if you have a temporary financial difficulty, there are also deferments and forbearances on the federal education loans, which are temporary suspensions of the obligation to repay. You still owe the money, and in some cases, the interest will continue to accrue, so you shouldn't persist on a deferment or forbearance for very long because you're just digging yourself into a deeper hole. But if you have medical leave or maternity leave, or you just lost your job and expect to get a new job in a few months, a temporary suspension of the monthly payments can be a useful way of dealing with it. If it's a more long-term financial difficulty, you need an alternate repayment plan like income-based repayment, and there are a few other plans, extended repayment, graduated repayment. All of these reduce the monthly payment by stretching out the term of the loan, which ultimately means you'll pay more in interest over the life of the loan than if you had stuck with standard 10-year repayment. But in many cases, borrowers who need these plans have no real other option but to choose one of these plans.
Mark Kantrowitz is a publisher of FastWeb.com and FinAid.org. He joined us from WQED in Pittsburgh. Thanks, Mark, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All Saints Day, All Souls Day, Dia de los Muertos. This time of year, many cultures remember those who have gone before. But funeral customs are changing, and NPR's Martin Costi reports on one cemetery company's efforts to keep up.
Americans aren't going for coffins like they used to. cremation is on the rise, as is the number of families who decide to dispose of the ashes somewhere other than a cemetery. Arnie Swanson recalls witnessing just such a scene.
My son and I were playing golf at a local golf course, and a group of individuals came out to the fairway. And later we found out the family were broadcasting their loved one who had been cremated on the fairway.
As it happens, Swanson is a market director for Dignity Memorial Service Corporation International, and he realized he was looking at lost business.
There just simply was not a product to meet the needs of this family.
Now, 3 years later, there is such a product.
So here we have our Sunset Hills Memorial Golf Park, and this was created to honor those who are passionate about the game of golf.
In a hilltop cemetery with views of downtown Seattle and the Olympic Mountains, a brand new, perfectly playable golf hole. The ashes of the dearly departed can be poured into a sealed vault that's hidden underneath the putting green. And that's just the beginning of the interment possibilities.
Phase one includes, of course, the green itself, the ossuary, the water feature, the leaderboard, and then, of course, the large sand trap, which has been gridded out, and there are actually burial spaces in the sand trap for those who have been cremated.
I don't really understand golf sensibility enough to understand why would someone want the sand trap. Isn't that kind of hell versus heaven?
Well, it is, but if you spent a lot of time in the sand trap while you were playing golf, while here at Sunset Hills Memorial Park, you have the opportunity to spend an eternity in the trap.
At this point, you might be wondering whether this whole thing is a bit of a put-on, but it appears to be legit. Swanson says he's already sold 3 plots, if you can call them that. Still, he does like his little golf jokes.
The one thing we don't allow here at Sunset Hills Memorial Golf Park are any mulligans. This is permanent.
No mulligans.
No mulligans.
So, got it.
Once you're here, you're here.
Gotcha.
Mulliganing golf is a do-over.
I understand.
The company plans to expand the Memorial Golf Hole concept to another one of its properties in Phoenix, and after that, maybe Las Vegas. Swanson says he might contemplate products that memorialize other kinds of sports, but really, golf is ideal. With its emphasis on quiet and lawn care, it just fits in among the gravestones.
The one unique thing about Sunset Hills is we guarantee you that everyone here finishes 6 under.
I've got a million of them.
Martin Costi, NPR News, Seattle.
This is NPR News.